Hey, what's going on, everybody? Welcome back to another episode of Everything is a Spring. Derek, how have you been, man?
Hey, Jim. I'm doing all right. I'm excited this week, you know. We got a lot of cool new stuff for Everything's a Spring. Not equipment, but more in the like visual graphics. So anyone who's listening to episode 5 today, or any day after we put it out, is going to see our brand new logo.
Yeah. Oh, that was fun. And so how did you get this logo done, man?
Oh, man. I would love to say that it was like a long, arduous process, but I went on Fiverr and ordered it. And it was that simple. Like, I just got really lucky. The artist we used was just super quick. I mean, he turned it around in a day. And I know I texted you, right? Like, hey, what do you think? And I think we made a couple of changes, just like script changes and like order of where things were, and he got it done. It looks great. And for our YouTube viewers, I just showed you a little clip. We have a new like animated intro too. So
yeah, I'm super excited. Oh, it looks awesome. So I'm
production value.
It does feel like very official. Like I'm very happy with it. Yeah, man, that's awesome.
Yeah, and I think I'm going to keep, like, you know, YouTube, we have our old, like, logo on the other videos, so I was thinking instead of re-uploading them with the new stuff, I'm just going to keep them, like, as a, hey, this is how we looked when we started, you know, the first 4 episodes, as a little, like, time capsule to how it all began.
Yeah, I think it's kind of fun to, like, include the progress, like, the natural progression of, like, our content and our quality. I think that's part of our story, right? It's part of like we're figuring it out and we're trying to make it all work. And that's just part of it.
Yeah. And I also figured for like our first, you know, what, 20 fans that actually listen to us, you know, they're not going to be expecting the new logo. So I figured, hey, this is the same channel, same guys, same podcast. Yeah, we're coming at you again with episode 5. I'm really excited to go, man. Like it's been a great week. I'll be honest with you. Like it's a great turnaround from last week. How about yours?
It's been good. I feel like I've gotten a lot of stuff done. Just a couple projects got wrapped up at work. So one of the things we're doing, I work with a, how do I put it? I guess it's like a raw material processing plant sort of thing.
That's cool.
But anyway, one of the products that we make is glitter. And yeah, I know,
of all
right?
The things I expected you to say.
not what you might have expected. But yeah, so I finished a glitter machine rebuild that we were working on. So that was nice.
Wait, how is glitter made?
There's a bunch of different ways, but basically you take a sheet of material and then you chop it in, you have like a rotating cutter head, and that chops it into little bits of material. And so the size of glitter is basically dictated by how fast you're feeding the material in. It starts as like a roll of film, right?
Like aluminum looking stuff, or
like it's almost like material? Mostly they're actually plastics, or like metallized plastics. So one side of it will have like a film, or very, very thin deposition of colored metal or whatever, reflective material. But it's mostly plastic, really. So, yeah. And then, it's just like a big roll of this film and it gets fed in, and how small you can cut is just dictated by how fast you can feed, or slow in this case, you can feed in the film, and how fast the blades are spinning. So it's kind of a neat operation. But yeah, so that's what I was been working on this week, and that got sorted out, which is good. And then with Whiskey Grail, I think we're making some good progress and getting to our production goals, which is good.
Nice. Does your fiscal year end in December, or is it like halfway through the year?
No, it is December. So yeah, so fiscal year ends the 30th of December, I suppose. But yeah, so we're on track to beat last year's production and sales numbers, which is excellent.
Oh, heck yeah, man.
Yeah, by a pretty good margin. Not as far along as we were hoping for, but we are making progress, and I think we'll be really well set up for next year because we're really still very much in growth mode. I mean, we really think that this thing's got some legs. So our goal is to be able to produce like 500 grails a week early next year.
For what? You got like what, 10 employees?
More now. It's like 11 or 12. I mean, we're growing really fast. which is presents its own challenges, but it's been pretty crazy, but it's been good, but it's been a good week.
Manager so. Jim, dude, that's awesome. There congrats, dude. Like, what's this, four Thanks, years, man. 5 years of Whiskey Grill?
This will be our third year. So, it started basically in, like Thanksgiving, between Thanksgiving and Christmas of 2020. So yeah, we're coming up on our third birthday.
Heck yeah, man. Congrats.
Yeah. Thanks, man. Thanks, man.
And then I love also, to see progress. That's awesome.
Oh, it's been great. And like, really, I've really been burning like the midnight oil the past, few months. And like, it feels like it's really finally starting to pay off a little bit. Even though like there's still so much work to do.
Behold the fruits of your own labor.
Exactly. And that's very satisfying to see. So, you know, there's still a long road ahead, but we are making progress and that progress is starting to show itself. So,
dude, you stay busy. You got the company, you got your side gig, and you got this going. And
hey, yeah, man. Well, you know, I like to be occupied. Yeah, man, for sure. And then on a side note, I picked up a canoe today off Facebook Marketplace. So I'm very excited. It's actually in pretty good shape. So I have to rebuild, I have to remake the yoke that you like carry it on.
Yeah.
So you can like carry it on your shoulders. But it's a really nice canoe. It's a little bit beat up around the edges, but I mean, that's fine.
What kind of material are we talking?
It's actually kind of an interesting material. So it's called, I think it's called like Rhinoflex. Let me look it up real quick.
Rhinoflex.
It's
it sounds like what every truck must be made of.
Let's see. Well, that's Rhino Liner, right? That's the
oh yeah, the stuff you put in the back.
Yes. Oh, what's the name of the brand? Hold on.
Take your time, Pastor. I got all day.
So the canoe, it's what's called Royalex, which was made by this company called Mohawk Canoes. And basically it's a ABS sheet that is basically it's a sandwich ABS sheet foam ABS sheet, and so it creates a really lightweight but strong material. It basically acts like an I-beam.
Oh, there you go. I was thinking like with the foam interior, it's going to make it super one and buoyant and also really easy to carry.
Yes, so it's very, very lightweight, but it's still pretty rigid. And so it's a very neat material. I mean, the canoe probably, it's a 15-foot canoe, and it probably weighs like 35 pounds.
That's nothing.
Yeah, maybe 40, 45, but very light.
Beats the crap out of the canoes we learned how to canoe on.
Like. The big aluminum or big plastic canoes.
Yeah. Hey, if you think about it, send me a picture. Sure. I'll overlay it for the folks to see it.
Yeah, will do. And then, so the only real work that needs to happen to it is I need to remake the yoke, and then I probably need to refinish like the seats, just because the wood is looking pretty rough.
Just give it a little new life.
Yeah, give it a good cleaning and extra, you know, fresh coat of varnish just to protect it.
Yeah. I bet it'll make it pop a little bit too.
Oh yeah, it's gonna look great. And honestly, the canoe already looks pretty decent. So
that's a good find for Facebook Marketplace.
Yeah, man. So apparently, there's like a pretty good crowd of canoe people around here, just because we've got so much black water and we've got some really good rivers for it too. So I found it on. Yeah, I mean, I've been looking for a little while. You know, it's been something I've wanted to have. Just because, again, there's a lot of really good canoeing opportunities around here. So
yeah, add it to Jim's ever-growing fleet of small boats.
That's true. I'm up to four.
Dang.
Which is a lot of boats. So
hey, you're about ready to break out another 1,000, but it's good that you know how to work on stuff, so you just save a lot of money that way.
That's true. And the canoe, I mean, it's a canoe. It's
right, like how hard could it be to maintenance?
Exactly. So, and you know, $300 and
that ain't bad, man.
It's not bad at all, you know, especially for what it is. So I'm excited to get that out on the water. Of course, it's winter time. So
yeah, is it maybe next spring?
Maybe in the spring. But I mean, who knows? I mean, it's still
stage. It's going to be like, climate change winter over here. So it's going to be warm for a while.
Yeah, I was looking at the forecast. And I believe that it's still going to be like 80 degrees sometime this week.
You're kidding.
Yeah. So Wednesday we have, Thursday even. So Thursday we have a high of 83.
For reference, it's the beginning of November for the listener.
Yeah, so that'll be like November 9th, I guess. It'll be 80 degrees in South Georgia. So that'll be good.
Yeah, you might be able to actually get it out. That's cool.
Yeah, yeah. So maybe, of course, it's in the middle of the week, but we'll see. We'll see what we can do.
That's the good thing about the canoe. It's pretty easy to just strap it on top of the car. There's less setup than the sailboat, so you can really hop on the water, hop off pretty quick if you had, like, what, 2 hours, give or take, of free time?
Yeah, exactly. And, like, I don't need a trailer. Like, the thing with the sailboats is that they got to trailer them, and then they're actually pretty heavy. So each hull is about 200 pounds, and then plus all the rigging and stuff. So it's pretty tough to move around by myself. So one of the things that I really want to do, but probably don't have time for, I really want to build a skin-on-frame sailboat. So just ultra light.
That'd be sick. Just don't hit anything.
That'd be super cool. Well, you got to be careful, yeah. But then it would be easy to throw up on top of the car and just go, which is the dream. So.
Yeah. Oh man, that sounds like a good day out. But you know, we're preloaded up. How about we go ahead and cruise on in.
All right, Derek, fair enough. That's enough preload for one day. So
got to save them something for next week, right?
We do. We have to. We got to keep it updated, you know, keep it fresh.
Keep the folks wanting more.
We can't give them too much, Derek. They would be, that'd be
please,
disastrous.
Sir, may I have another story of your back life?
What would you do with too much Jim and Derek? How would you contain that?
Too spill? Much Jim and Derek? Now, that's not a spring because it's incalculable. There's no such thing.
There's no such thing. There's no such thing as too much Jim and Derek. So, Derek, what is your favorite power generation method?
Favorite power generation method? I'm going to break the entire mold here and say nuclear, right? Not like 1960s nuclear, but like modern nuclear power is pretty safe, all things considered.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Yeah, there's a lot of misconceptions around nuclear energy.
Nuclear power. I would love to visit a nuclear power plant. We have one in Georgia called Vogtle, but I don't know if I'll be able to visit. Like, I don't even know if they take visitors.
I think they do offer tours, actually.
That'd be pretty sick. I don't know. Nuclear power to me is just one of those. It's the easiest way for me as like a layman to understand how basic nuclear physics works. So I've spent a lot of time just reading up on, you know, nuclear generators. Probably accidentally got on a list, but just learning how. This is very feasible, and I could see in our lifetime, right, Jim? There's probably going to be a bunch of nuclear power plants built in the United States, especially with, like, everyone trying to get, like, carbon neutral and crap by 2030.
It's interesting, right? Because, like, I think, like, nuclear is a really good option for clean or cleaner energy, but there's a lot of political pushback because people are scared of it.
Yeah, they don't understand. It's not going to go, like, Chernobyl on you. You know, the technology has changed.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's come a long way, obviously. I mean, that's not to say there aren't dangers
there's
with
risk.
It and there aren't risks involved, but there's
like the last thing you want to do is taint the groundwater with radioisotopes, but a lot has to go wrong in rapid succession. A lot of people have to fail. A lot of systems have to fail for us to get to that now.
Yeah. And especially a lot of nuclear waste is actually stored dry now, so there's really not much chance for contaminant, for leakage anyway, because it's solid, basically. So it can't leach into the groundwater if it's not a liquid.
There you go. Can't dissolve.
And speaking of liquids, well, let me ask you another question. So if nuclear power is your favorite source of electricity, what is your least favorite source of electricity?
My least favorite source of electricity? Yeah. Coal, man.
Oh, coal. Okay.
Coal, man.
Well,
like, name one good thing that's come from coal. Like, of course, we have to get off the ground, Industrial Revolution stuff.
Yeah.
Of course, I understand that. But haven't we moved on? You know, we have like new types of natural gas and like really high octane petroleum products. Why are we still using coal, man?
Well, that's a good question, Derek. And today we're going to talk a little bit about coal and shall we call it seepage? Moist seepage.
Oh, God. The alternative, the alternative name for this miniseries.
Just really give the listeners what they want. That moist seepage.
Oh, God.
I feel like seepage is one of those words that people just don't like.
I feel like we don't use it enough for people not to like seepage. I'm worried more about the moist part.
Moist. I don't know. I feel like seepage is like, ew, that's kind of gross.
Seepage.
Seepage.
Weird fluids. Yeah,
so oh, God. Oh, God. Anyway, so moving swiftly along, we're going to... Today, we're going to talk about an event that happened on Monday, December 22nd, 2008.
Oh, this is real recent.
This is very recent.
And it's right before Christmas.
Yeah, so Merry Christmas. Here's a bunch of coal and ash slurry delivered directly into your house, courtesy of the TVA.
The Tennessee Valley. I love the Tennessee Valley Authority.
The good old Tennessee Valley Authority.
Not the one from Marvel, guys. This isn't the TVA or the time variance crap that they were doing. We're talking about the real TVA.
We're talking about the real TVA.
They make a good damn. I got to give the TVA credit. They make a good damn.
This time. You'd have thought with as much dam building experience as they have, this wouldn't have happened.
Oh, my God.
So let me give you a little bit of background. So we're looking today at the Kingston Fossil Plant, which is a coal power plant that's operated basically it's on a peninsula between the Emory River and the Clinch River, and is just 4 miles upstream from the Tennessee River.
In the state of Tennessee?
We are, yes. Okay. We are in the state of Tennessee. Rowan County, Tennessee. And basically this is one of 6 coal-fired plants at the time that is using what's called wet storage let me back up a little bit more. So when you burn coal industrially to create power, what you do is you actually grind the coal up to a very fine powder. And the reason that you do this is so you can blast air into the fire, and that will basically like lift the coal into the air, and then it will combust very, very evenly, quite rapidly. So you get a very efficient burn out of it. It's almost like...
Oh, so instead of having to have the coal like chunks ignite, you can have...
You don't really have like lumps. Yeah, you don't really have lumps of coal. They grind it up and like basically blow it into the combustion chamber.
I'm sure that's great for the lungs of the workers that have to shovel this crap in.
Well, most of it's automated at this point. And the workers on site have the correct protective equipment to deal with that type of...
Oh, I guess it is 2008, so that's good. We have good respirators and such, ventilation.
Yes, that will come into play later. Don't you worry.
A surprise tool.
We've got that in the chamber later in the episode. So, but anyway, so they basically grind up the coal into this very fine powder and then blow it into the furnace where it burns, and that heat is used to generate steam, and steam turns the turbines, etc. So, one of the byproducts for that process is the production of ash. And in the coal industry, it's called coal fly ash. And basically that's because it's, you know, basically flown coal. And so it's very, very fine particles of ash that drop out. And they have lots of, you know, really lovely components in them. You know, things like arsenic and benzene and mercury.
Oh, all the carcinogens.
All the carcinogens, yeah. So it's really lovely stuff. There's basically 2 ways that this is contained the waste is processed, right?
All right.
So the first way is that, let me back up a little bit more again. So once that ash is created, you know, we've regulated the coal industry enough to the point that we don't allow the coal plants to just blow the ash up into the atmosphere and let it settle.
We're past that.
We're past that. So the companies are required to capture the ash and then deal with it somehow. And so generally what happens is the ash is actually funneled. Basically, it's blown into water. And then so the ash hits the water, and then it saturates the ash and makes it heavy and drops it makes it so that it drops out of the airstream, basically.
Right. And you can just drain out the water into whatever tank you need to.
Yes. So at this particular plant, the Kingston power plant, the way that they were dealing with their ash disposal is basically they have several ponds that contain the ash in different stages of its disposal. So the first stage of the disposal is basically where it's like very wet, and basically you have it's a retaining pond, and the idea is that you let the ash settle out to the bottom. You just kind of like let it sit, and the ash will drop out, and then you can pump the water away, and then get the ash and scoop it up, and it's not completely dry yet, so you scoop it up and you put it into another containing pond. The second one is called the stilling pond. So in the stilling pond, you kind of do the same thing. You pull it out, you dump it in, and you let the water like dry out even more. And then there's a third and final one, which is kind of like your permanent storage, where basically you the dewatering pond, where you let it dry. So you let it dry, and then you just keep dumping more ash on top of it. It's basically just a big pit that is full of this dry ash material.
And by that time, is it still like arid? I don't know the best way to say it. Is it still so fine that if you like disturb it, it's going to go into the air at that last pond?
No, because it's still technically damp, right? So
okay.
When it's put into that other pond, there's still water in it, but there's not enough water that you can like pump it out or let it dry out or whatever. So you just kind of dump it into this pit and just kind of let it sit there, I guess.
I guess it's better than the alternative. It's, so these retaining ponds, for my reference, are they outside, like open air?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, they're okay. Open air. Yeah, so that's the last step, is kind of this above ground dewatering pond, or they call it the solid waste containment pond. So that's basically where all this stuff is just dumped, and it's just it's pretty much just left there. That's, I guess, the idea of like how it's going to work. Of course, the thing is that because they're open air, any rainwater that comes down is going to get into it, and so it kind of keeps it like moist, right? So there's still like water in this little pond, but there's not as much, and it's pretty minimal. So these ponds are not lined with anything. It's basically just a clay dam, and so over time, you know, these are called dikes. These were ponds were built in like the 60s, and basically the idea is that groundwater actually is really very difficult to contain, and so as the water from rain hits the ash, it transfers into the walls of the dams, or the dikes in this case, and the water can actually create little seep holes or weep holes through the dam. And this is actually one of the major causes of earthen embankment failure, is basically you'll get a water path that will go through the dam as like almost like a little pinprick. And then that will create like rapid erosion through that pinhole, and it'll collapse the dam, and then that'll create like this tidal wave that just destroys everything.
So I'm guessing all this ash being particulate in that water is just helping it cut away.
Yeah, so we'll get to that. So there's a couple leaks that happen that the TVA is aware of. There's one that happens in 2003 and then in 2006. And basically what they do to fix this is they stop dumping wet ash into the dewatering pond in order to let everything kind of dry out, right? Because like once you let everything dry out, there's no more water, there's no more groundwater in the dike, so the dike will stop leaking because there's not enough groundwater pressure to like push water through that clay. Because clay is actually relatively impermeable, but it's not completely impermeable. So that's what they did, is they're just like, okay, let everything dry out, let everything stabilize. The problem with that is it really doesn't address the underlying cause of the seepage, which is that there's no impermeable barrier or no membrane to stop the seepage of potentially contaminated water that's coming from this ash.
And they didn't. And since the 60s, not once did they add more clay or like another layer. I don't know how these retaining things are supposed to work, but it sounds like their general reaction was just to wait it out.
So It seems like the TVA has been making like these small repairs. Okay, so here's like a part of it. So they basically were making these small repairs to kind of try to like just move it along, because so the TVA is, it's a federally owned utility company, but it does not receive any funding from like taxpayer dollars. It operates as a for-profit company. It's just owned by the federal government. So part of the problem with that, at least in my opinion, is that they have kind of this dual citizenship, as it were. So like they are part of the federal government.
Between two worlds.
Yeah, they can kind of walk between the lines. So they're part of the federal government, which means they have a lot of authority. And that means that a lot of times people don't question them.
True.
But they're also a corporation, which means their primary motivator is profit. And so if you can reduce your costs by just kind of nursing along this outdated and known to be leaking and slightly faulty, coal ash storage system, rather than switching over to this. So there is another method of storage for this stuff, which is a fully dry containment. It's more expensive than this wet containment, but it doesn't have the, well, we're going to talk about the potential risk in a minute. Exactly. Yeah. So the TVA kind of walks between this line of being both a federally owned and operated entity, but also being a corporation. And so that has caused some interesting, problems, which we'll talk about in a minute. So
it sounds like conflict of interest, the entity, like that's rough.
Yeah. And that's been one of the critiques of the TVA for a long time, is kind of that there is this conflict of interest inherent in its operation. And so that's something that people have critiqued for a long time, but we'll get into that a little bit later. So in 2008, in October of 2008, another one of these small leaks is detected. And so the report is being generated, but it hasn't been completed yet at the time of the spill.
Right. Because so, I mean, think about it. Asking a federal entity to approve any kind of report and have it go through all of the stopgaps, that's months and months of time.
Exactly. So from October, that somebody was aware that, hey, this wall is seeping. Right. There is a seepage of basically coal fly ash goop happening.
Right. That's checkpoint one. They had an early notice.
And they had historical notice that this was happening. And that's important to know. So the spill begins sometime between midnight and 1 a.m. on December 22nd. So middle of the night.
Yeah. Third shift. Everyone's at their top, I'm sure. Monitoring capacity.
And the dike surrounding the ash containment dewatering pond breaks. And it occurs on the northwest corner of the pond. So it's overlooking Swan Creek, the Swan Creek spillway. And so it basically, the dike breaks and there's this wall of sludge ash that just pours out.
Ooh.
And there's this one initial large wave that lasts for about a minute, and then there's like a bunch of smaller waves that happen afterwards. And because it's like such a fine particulate suspended in water, it's just really flowy. And the initial estimate is that 1.7 cubic yards of sludge were released. And then once they did an aerial survey, they tripled that. So it was 5.4 million cubic yards were released into the surrounding areas, covering 300 acres of land and contaminating the nearby local waterways.
Holy cow. And this happens, what you said, in a minute? This wave just...
Yeah, in a matter of minutes. I mean,
there's no way to even project that.
No. So, I mean, it's incredibly fast. It's titanic almost. Like it's reminiscent of like a mud flow created from like a volcano, right? Because it's this similar type of consistency.
Sheesh.
So 12 homes are destroyed. Fortunately, nobody dies in the miraculously, I will say. Nobody dies in the initial the flow.
Right. But 12 homes destroyed. That's 12 a homes, lot of property damage right off the rip.
That's not even all of it. So 12 homes are destroyed. One of them is completely pushed off of its foundation. There's damage to 42 additional properties. It washes out a road. It ruptures a gas line. It destroys railway.
Wait, it destroys a railway?
Well, like, so it completely obstructs the tracks.
Flooded it?
It floods it, yeah. And then it's covered with this sludge, like a train can't get through it.
Yeah, you're not braking.
You're not going through that. And then it ruptures a gas line. It destroys power lines, breaks water mains. 22 residences were evacuated later, but nobody was injured during the flow, which is incredible.
Wow. That's really lucky. I mean, yeah, it's just luck.
And like part of this, I have to imagine that it happened in the middle of the night, you know, so people are asleep. Like imagine if people have been on the roads and when this happened, you know.
You're right. Like if that happened, rush hour traffic, you're looking at people drowning in their cars potentially.
Yeah. I mean, that would be really
horrible. Or getting
washed
off the road.
Yeah. That would be really, really horrible. Yeah, that's pretty bad. And then it's the largest industrial spill in the United States. So it's more than ever. Yeah. So the next biggest one is the Martin County sludge spill of 2000, which spilled basically 306 million gallons of also, as it would happen, liquid coal waste. Yeah, wow. Exactly.
They say
the
lightning
same
doesn't
thing.
Strike twice, but you know.
Here we are. Yeah, so this one is 1.1 billion with a B U.S. Jeez. Gallons of sludge, which is enough to fill 1,660 Olympic-sized swimming pools, which is an ungodly number.
It's hard to even imagine.
Absolutely. So that's pretty bad. The other two containment pools, thankfully, stayed intact, which is really, really good. I mean, that would have tripled, basically, the destruction. So,
and it's good that it wasn't one of those chain reaction situations like we've covered before.
Yeah.
Where, like, one retaining pool fails and then
it floods into the
next one.
Yeah, wipes out the next retaining pond and adds everything. Yeah, so fortunately, that did not happen. Unfortunately, like, basically, the wave of sludge hits the Emory River and like it launches fish, like ejects fish from the river, launching them like 40 feet inland.
Right?
So imagine being a fish, right? And you're just like swimming along, doing your thing.
Vibing.
And then it's just like, and you're like launched 40 feet off the stream bank by a wave of sludge.
I like to think that there was some fisherman downstream. You just start seeing fish fly out of the sea, you know, or fly out of the river.
Yeah.
He had a good day for like 10 minutes.
That'd be pretty funny. And then so obviously like this, all this coal sludge gets into the river and it kills, I mean, it destroys a huge chunk of the ecosystem.
Yeah. Part of me is just like, knock, knock. It's the EPA before we got defunded. What happened to the groundwater?
Excuse me? What do you mean happened to the groundwater? So basically what there's been an investigation into this and the cause of it, which the report was released in 2009. What they basically see as the cause of it is basically the below the retaining pond, there was a layer of coal ash, I guess from previous building or previous coal processing. And then that as the water seeps down, it creates this very slippery surface because the coal ash is such a fine particulate. Mm. And that was allowing that moisture to seep into the dike. And so then once the moisture is in the dike, it creates that erosion. And then eventually you have that catastrophic failure where there's just not enough strength in the dike to prevent the pressure of the fluid from pushing out and away. So what ends up happening, I guess what really ends up happening is that you have this purportedly solid material, like the quote unquote dry, dewatered coal ash, which if it was actually dry would act as a solid and not as a liquid. But because of the rainwater, there's rain that happens recently. And of course they're adding additional wet coal ash to be dewatered, basically all the water has to evaporate out. That adds enough water into the system where it begins to act as a liquid which exerts pressure on the walls of its storage container.
So what you're telling me, Jim, is that even coal slurry is a spring?
Even coal slurry is a spring, and it can act as a fluid with enough water moisture content. So,
because I'm thinking, like, you're right, adding more coal slurry to the mix, you're just adding all that pressure, pushing it further down. Exactly. And this happens...
And this pond has been being filled up for decades. I mean, like,
right. And you said 5 years since the last failure, or the last time they saw like a problem enough to report, right? Like 2003 to 2008, they got away with it.
No, there's one in 2006 as well.
Oh,
yes. So basically, and this is kind of, I guess, what happens, right? Is you notice there's a leak, and you're like, okay, stop adding stuff to the dewatering pond, because what that inherently does is it adds water to the system.
Right.
Which increases the moisture content of the ash, causes it to behave more like a fluid, potentially erodes the dikes, and also exerts additional pressure on the onto the dikes, which can create these problems. So that happens in 2003, and it happens in 2006, and then again they find it happening in 2008, but they don't do anything about it. So yeah, it's kind of like, I don't know, it seems weird to me.
I think this kind of gets to where we were talking about at the beginning, you know, they walk between two worlds. They are the regulatory body in a way by being representative of the federal government, but they have this incentive for profit. So what's two more years of we've gotten away with it before? It hasn't been a problem.
Exactly.
Same old story.
And so to compound that, right? Coal ash slurry is actually, and coal ash in general, is actually not a regulated substance, right? Like by the EPA, right?
Oh, so, there we go.
Yeah. So basically, because there's been political pressure put on the government in 2000, basically, fly ash was not regulated as a hazardous waste by the EPA. And it still is not, actually.
Wait, really?
Yeah.
Just described arsenic, benzene, and I think one other very carcinogenic substance, and it's not regulated?
Yes, correct. So, because politics, basically.
Oh, I forgot that doesn't make money, Jim. That's my...
Yeah. So, and I think part of this, too, is like, this is, I don't know, like coal... That's the tough thing about it, right? Is like coal is or has been such a huge part of the country's development, right? I mean, right. The Industrial Revolution
built on coal
was built on coal,
built
yeah,
on
absolutely.
Steam engines, you know, like
yeah, and coal-fired power plants, even very recently, have been a huge right. part of the power generation of this country, and so they have a lot of political sway.
Don't want to take people's jobs away, right?
Exactly. Yeah, you don't want to take people's jobs away, and you don't want to, you know, potentially put companies out of business by leveraging additional expense onto them.
Right.
You know, but the also, reality is, you know, we gotta deal with the byproducts of this responsibly. So, anyway, yeah. So that's like a whole big thing. Yeah, so, and there's like 6 feet of this stuff in places, 6 feet thick, just sludge, coal ash sludge.
I don't even know how you clean that up.
Yeah, so it's tough, right? And so basically, yeah, there's all these concerns about like, is this stuff toxic? Is this stuff, like, how fast can we clean this up? How fast do we need to clean this up?
Yeah, how long do you have before it seeps into groundwater or like hits a well?
Exactly. So
Tennessee folks have their own like spring. I mean, I hate to say spring in that context, but you know, like actual
water,
groundwater
yeah, like
springs.
Actual groundwater yeah. springs. And so, yeah, there's a lot of fear from local residents that there's water contamination is going to be a big issue.
And let me guess, the federal government's just like, hey, don't worry about it.
Yeah, basically. So the EPA and the Tennessee Department of Environment and Conservation, basically, they immediately began testing the water quality. So early tests for water upstream of the ash flow show that the water's cool. So the upstream is good. That seems to be fine.
Okay. As expected, right?
Yeah, like you would expect that. I feel like that's something that shouldn't surprising.
The control in this experiment.
That's the control. So downstream and near the spill, they test, the TVA tests the water. And they show elevated levels of lead and thallium and quote-unquote barely detectable levels of mercury and arsenic.
Oh, good old trace amount mercury.
Yeah, so then, you know, somebody else, I guess, says basically, hey, like, this is, we should probably do an independent test.
Right, just like, I get that you have your federal scientists, and not bashing the folks that do that job, but it is good to have peer review, right?
Yes.
It's good to redo the experiment, especially over several pieces of time, because like you said, even if the scientists do the right work, they can't control what happens with that report after they submit it, you know what
Correct.
I mean? There are incentives above their heads, and so and sometimes they're aware of it, sometimes they're not.
So the Appalachian State University's environmental toxicology and chemistry labs did a different, an independent sample analysis, and they showed significantly elevated levels of toxic metals, arsenic, copper, barium, cadmium, chromium. I mean, these are all really heavy metals.
So
lead, mercury, nickel, and
thallium.
They
didn't even scrape the surface comparatively.
Yeah, I mean, and like these are all really bad.
Right. Look at your periodic table. It's not good.
No, yeah. I mean, like specifically like chromium, I know is a very, very destructive heavy metal to be in the body.
Right, these are some of the materials we test for in biocompatibility. Like as you're talking about your manufacturing material, like getting a new provider of materials, we have to make sure that there's no trace materials on top of what they give us, right?
Yes.
It's the fact that all that's detected by a university with university grade equipment means something must have went wrong with the reporting or like the what they consider tolerable levels, right?
Yeah, and so that's like the kind of the first level of suspicion that I was reading through, and I was like, this is
set weird. The alarm off.
Yeah, that was like my first red flag. So then pretty much immediately, they're like, we have to like stop this from getting into the Tennessee River because obviously
if it does that it's going across states.
Yeah, that'd be very, very bad. So they one of the actually good things about this being part of the TVA is that they are basically able to immediately slow the flow of water down the the Clinch River because it's controlled by
the
TVA dam.
Oh,
exactly.
I guess that's the one positive thing of controlling everything is like if you want to do the right thing, it's easy to. You know?
It's easy, yeah. So they're able to slow. They dump about a bunch of rock into the Clinch River to prevent that from the sludge from flowing downstream. They slow down the flow of water into the Clinch River.
I guess that also acts as a filter, right, in a way?
Yes, yes. And then it does. And then they immediately start bringing the slurry. They immediately start cleanup and clearing the slurry from the river and the local ponds that were contaminated back up. And they just are dumping it back into one of the intact containment ponds for now.
You're kidding me. So they go, wait, hold up, time out. I was just thinking, they're going to go do the other way of processing. They go back to the retaining ponds, the other two that didn't break?
They do eventually go do it the right way, but for now, like,
come
they're just like, we gotta get this. Well, it's okay. So look at it this way. It's like, okay, this has happened, but now we have to get this out of the river as fast as we can. Where do we put it?
I guess there's no other place, but it's so weird to think like this thing just broke. Put it back.
That's the long and short of it. Just put it back. Exactly.
If it's the best option, I guess they know what they're doing.
So, well, yeah, but anyway.
Sheesh.
Yeah, it's not ideal, but so
the comedic timing of that is so goofy.
It's pretty bad. It's just like, just put it back. Just put it back upstream.
Just put it back, man. Just
put it back. So basically, they request the assistance of the Army Corps of Engineers to dredge the river, to get the sludge out of it, basically.
They usually call the Army Corps of Engineers when they're out of luck.
Yeah, they do. And they
like, help us.
Hey, please help. Yeah, exactly. And then rather they announced that basically on January 1st of 2009, the TVA announces that rather than clearing away all of the slurry, Okay. They're instead, they're going to spray seed straw and mulch on top of it to prevent it from scattering, basically. And this is basically done as a stopgap measure. So
what? I'm sorry. I know that my face didn't come up on the audio version of the podcast, but holy crap. Listen, guys. Listen, we've been dumping, we've been scooping since Christmas, right? Forget that. What we're going to do now, we're just going to put some mulch over it. We got the Four Seasons Landscaping Company. They're going to dump a bunch of mulch. It's going to be beautiful mulch. Just don't worry about it.
Let's just make a playground on top of all this sludge.
Oh my God. It's just, I know I'm probably misunderstanding, like, this is what you're supposed to do, but you have to understand how goofy that sounds. Can you imagine waking up, one, you're not supposed to be working because your federal government is New Year's, and you hear that? Mulch. That's the solution. Army Corps of Engineers is just like, what?
So, as ridiculous as it sounds, here's the justification. So, basically, help me understand. What you've done, right, or what has happened, is that all of this wet slurry has spread out over, so it was originally contained in an 84 acre pond, basically, and it has now been spread out over a 300 acre area. So what that basically means is that it's going to start drying out much, much faster.
And you're spreading it out.
You're spreading it out. And because it's such a fine particulate, if it dries out completely, there is the risk of it getting airborne. Because
then you're thinking about, like, give me data on the how much did cancer like screenings go up in this area.
Exactly. And then on top of that, if it rains and the ash is basically quote unquote unprotected,
right,
the water that hits that ash is actually gonna carry it back into the stream system. So by having the mulch and stuff on it, you're basically just keeping the ash where it is.
Oh, so this is like a, since they're pressed on time,
yes,
this is like the measure to prevent it from aerosolizing and potentially getting put into the major water supplies downstream.
Yeah, so that makes sense. Yeah, this is just a time buying measure.
So it's not the solution, but it's something that's like, this is a preventative measure to make this a less, minimize the ecological disaster we're already facing.
Correct, basically.
Okay.
So that's good, right?
We'll take steps.
What's less good is that, obviously other people are trying to take photos of this. They're trying to get water samples. And the TVA illegally detains several people and threatens several other people with prosecution if they go and try to take and enter the public waterways.
What? Which is... the federal government detaining people for taking pictures of their mistakes? No way.
Yeah, so that's not good. There's another red flag of like, okay.
Maybe they are the TVA from Marvel. They're just like scooting people away.
Oh, the TVA is like super, super shady. There's a pretty long history of like, the TVA is this really big, powerful government agency, basically. Mm-hmm. But it's not really a government agency, sort of.
It's like the yet menacing government agency.
It's like the worst of both worlds. Like they're a government agency, but they're not.
That can make money.
Yeah, like they're a corporation, so they're funded. Their primary, their primary incentive is profit. But they're also a government agency, which means that they can use eminent domain and this kind of stuff.
Right.
But they're also not run by elected officials. Their main board is appointed by the president. So
which is a part of the company side of things.
Which is kind of, so it's like this really weird dynamic where it's very hard to hold the TVA accountable for things because they're just so powerful, really.
Yeah, and anyone who's driven through the South, even if you don't remember, if you've gone over a large dam as a bridge, it's probably been the TVA if you're talking like Georgia, Carolinas, Tennessee, that area.
Yeah. So
like Appalachia.
So basically, in the midst of all this, they're detaining these people. They're trying to prevent people from getting independent water samples. The TDEC, which is the the Tennessee Department of Environment and Conservation, TDEC, states that it is satisfied with the water quality in the wake of the spill, but it would continue to examine and deal with the potential chronic health effects. So
we put that in layman's terms. It's cool, man. Don't look at it. Hey, basically, what are you doing with that vial? Get away from there.
Yes, that is exactly what happens, which is always shady. That's never something that you want to see happening, especially because like these are people operating on public lands. They have every right to be there, and the TVA illegally detained them. So not great.
Nothing to see here, folks. Move it along.
Exactly. So there's more statements about like the toxicity of the ash, and this actually reignites this debate about the potential regulation of coal ash, right? So obviously people are like taking videos and posting them online about like all the dead fish in the Clinch River, and it's getting That's on true. The news channel.
It's 2008. Like, we got MySpace.
We got it. We like the early YouTube.
We got Twitter, I think.
And so the TVA spokesman basically says, this is quote, right, in terms of toxicity, until an analysis comes in, you can't call it toxic, end quote.
What? Derek, all right.
Derek, your thoughts.
Are you kidding me? Like, oh, imagine this. Nuclear disaster happens. Listen, man. Our scientists have not independently confirmed that this is radioactive. Therefore, it's not. Also, forget about that eye that you're growing. Don't worry about it. God damn, man. You're kidding me. They literally hit you with this, the age-old, don't worry about it. Like, you got university students like, hey, you know, I'm writing my thesis and lab report on this. If we can detect it in university grade lab equipment in the middle of Appalachia, you know, you're hiding something.
It gets better. It gets better. So he goes on and he says this, quote, it does have some heavy metals within it, but it's not toxic or anything, end quote.
Oh my God. It's just like every sentence. He's just like, no, it's fine. Insert the most jarring shit you've ever heard from a toxicology perspective, but don't worry about it.
Yeah, so obviously a lot of people were like, no. And
you don't have to be a scientist to know that that's bull.
Yeah.
Start to finish bullshit.
Absolutely. And so, yeah, people are not like super pleased about this.
They're not buying it, thankfully.
They're not buying it. And there's like a lot of like environmental groups that are coming after this spill and saying like, hey, this is a big problem. And they're trying to get them to regulate coal ash, which they end up actually getting to happen. So, you know, basically in 2008, the other thing that happens very, very recently is that President Barack Obama is elected president. And so...
And the housing market.
And the housing market, yeah, absolutely.
2008 was a rough year.
That sucks for those people whose houses got destroyed because of
right?
this.
Right? How are you going to replace
and
it?
In that market? Maybe it was
that's
a good thing.
And think about it. He was, at this point, Barack Obama would have been president for a month. That's a heck of an ecological disaster to start a presidency on.
Well,
right?
Yeah, so he, at the time of the spill, he's not even taken office, right? Because the president doesn't take office until January 7th?
So at that point, W's on it, or is he out the door already?
Well, they're out the door, right? So this is kind of like, this is called the lame duck presidency, right? Basically is when the president has lost and is going out of office, but is technically still in office, and basically just nobody does anything.
Right. You're packing up your office.
Yeah, you know? Like you're getting out, basically. And obviously, like, we knew that George W. Bush was not going to be the president, and that was his second term, but right. I guess Obama was running against Romney at that point.
When like politics wasn't as scary.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. Anyways, oh my goodness. Let's divert.
Slide to the left.
Yes, divert that whole discussion. But anyway, we don't need to get political here. So anyway, basically what happens is that there's a new EPA head that's being installed into because of the change in
right.
in the administration. And so this person's name is Lisa Jackson, and she basically says like, hey, because of this accident, we're going to start reviewing all of the coal ash disposal sites in the country.
That's good.
Angry politicians are angry, but eventually the EPA in 2015. So it takes them like 6 years to get this done.
Good thing he got two terms, because like that work would have just gone incomplete, right?
If well, like... maybe, right? So like this is kind of interesting, is like, because like we live in such a divisive time where it feels like the anything that the previous administration does, the new administration just immediately is like, nope, we're not doing that anymore. And they go in a different direction, but it didn't used to be that way. So I think
I have to remember, like, some people cared about their job, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So I guess like in 2012, it was he was running against, John McCain, right? So I don't know. I don't know what John McCain's stance on like environmental protection was. But I could see like this, okay, this is already in progress.
Like get the job done.
I could see the new administration coming in and just saying, okay, let's continue moving forward.
And then they get to take credit for it.
Exactly.
Like, the end, right? That's good.
Exactly.
That's
like,
a
that's
net
good.
Positive for them.
Yeah. So like I guess that's part of it. But anyway, I don't know how the political machine works.
Yeah, it's hard. It's so like you have, it I sucks that we have to think about it though. Like, and especially in a disasters like this, because who's in charge does drive the response, you know?
It really does. It really does. So anyway, in 2015, the EPA publishes a coal combustion residuals regulation, so CCR. And basically what it means is it says, it has four main tenets. Existing ash ponds that are contaminating groundwater must stop receiving coal combustion residuals and close or retrofit with a liner.
That's fair. So that's that permanent barrier you're talking about. I'm guessing it's just some kind of plastic, right?
Basically, is what I understand, is it's basically just a big plastic sheet that creates an impermeable barrier.
We install big Ziploc bag and save the day.
Yeah, pretty much. And then two, existing ash ponds and landfills must comply with structural and location restrictions where applicable or close. So, you know,
Don't downstream or upstream from a city.
Well, you know, maybe don't put your ash ponds on a bluff in a peninsula directly overlooking two different river systems.
You know, the hindsight's 20/20, but yeah, I can see that. That seems reasonable.
It seems reasonable.
What else we got?
Three, a pond no longer receiving CCR is still subject to all regulations unless it is dewatered, i.e. dried out, and covered so it cannot get more water by 2018.
That's a good one. There's like, seems hey, reasonable. If you're going, you can't just wipe your hands of it, you yes. know. Okay, that's good.
Yeah, basically. And then four, new ponds and landfills must include a geomembrane liner over a layer of compacted soil, which basically means that you don't have this danger of like the water getting into the dikes and eroding it from the bottom. And creating this pressure that can then push it out.
This actually sounds really logical in regards to preventing something like this. And the fact that no one died for it to happen is phenomenal. It's rare, you know?
Don't worry. We'll get to that.
Uh-oh.
So because this is such a logical and I would say that this is a fairly reasonable... Would you say this is a fairly reasonable
That doesn't seem
regulation?
Like you're asking... You're not asking for much, honestly. You're asking for the bare minimum, pretty much long and short of it. If you're going to have a pond, make sure it has a barrier, like a semi-permeable barrier that can be, you know, long and short of it, replaced when needed, right? If you're going to...
Well, I don't think you... They're not generally replaceable, but, like, they could be patched, I suppose. But
okay, so you're just adding to it.
Yeah.
If you're going to close the retaining pond, you don't just get to walk away, you know.
Yep.
Make sure it's dry, cover it, then you can walk away, fine. It's going to get regulated until the end of its life. That makes sense, right?
Yep. Well, so I would say that, obviously, because it's such a reasonable regulation, it gets challenged in the courts.
Of course. I mean, why would it, you know? Nothing's easy.
Yep. Yep. And so the United States Courts of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit Court basically sent back some of the regulation EPA for further rulemaking. And they're like, hey, you got to.
Oh, God.
So finally, in 2020, the EPA releases a final regulation for this, requiring all unlined ash ponds to retrofit or close by April of 2021.
Now, that sounds great on paper,
but
I think you and I remember what happened in 2020.
it's the COVID. Yeah. So, well, I guess August 28th, this would actually be during the COVID pandemic. So there is also opportunity for facilities to apply to obtain additional time to close up to 2028 to find alternatives for managing the ash wastes before they close their service impoundments.
I have a dumb question, Jim.
Yes.
So we've gone from this event in 2008, now the legislation written in 2018, to trying to get the final version out around 2020, 2021. Isn't that about the time where they defunded the EPA?
Yes, it is. Although, I don't know of any... In my research for this, I was not able to find if that had any impact on the... on the application of these regulations.
And I hope it's still working, because that sounds like logical and very reasonable regulation to have for a long-term problem since the 60s. I hope it actually came through.
My understanding is that the regulation is still in effect. I suppose question of how...
it enforced is the $80 question.
Well, I guess the thing is, like, so the Trump administration, which deregulated a lot of things and defunded the EPA to a certain extent, really was in effect from 2016 to 2020. Once the Biden administration has come in, the EPA has regained a lot of its authority.
Oh, so they're not defunded at this point.
They have been refunded. All right,
that's good.
Although I would say it's still a weaker organization than it was pre-Trump.
Yeah, I mean, if you take someone's kneecaps out, you're never going to walk the same again, you know?
Yeah, exactly. So they're still regrowing their kneecaps, but so they're able to kind of continue this through through the Trump years and get it to the present. So that's kind of the regulatory fallout of this thing. We still have to talk about the cleanup, because this is actually where we get into a lot of the still ongoing litigation and court battles that are still happening because of this incident. We're almost 15 years past that incident at this point, and there are still things happening in the courts because of it. So
understandable, because hey, if you're telling me I'm not going to worry about it, it's not toxic day one. You know how people are. You know how most average civilians, they're not going to worry about it if they're told not to, right?
Yeah, it's not good. It's not good. So basically, the TVA hires a California-based company called Jacobs Engineering to clean up the spill. And the EPA initially estimates, like, hey, 4 to 6 weeks, we're going to be done with this.
That's wishful.
Which is extremely wishful. There's other critics that are like, this is going to take months or years. You know, like, it's going to be a huge time. By June of 2009, 6 months following the spill, only 3% of the spill had been cleared.
Oh.
Yeah, and the estimate to clean the whole thing was going to be like almost $1 billion, just short of $1 billion. According to
6 months, 3%, and all those toxins are just sitting in your groundwater, getting pumped up by folks. No one's changed their goddamn Brita filter in years, man.
Well, we don't know if it gets into the groundwater yet, because the groundwater is like really deep. But there is definitely there's definitely like some concern about like the rivers, especially.
Poor fish, man.
Yeah, dude, it would suck to be a fish in that river. So basically, the cleanup is being done by this third party, and wouldn't you know it, the workers are not provided with the personal protective equipment necessary to protect them from exposure to the hazardous chemicals within the coal ash.
It is stupidity on municipalities all the way down. Like,
it is. It is. Well, this is really the company.
It's not the worker's responsibility to know what they need. That's your responsibility as the company that hires them to protect your employees.
Yes.
Why? Every freaking industry, it happens every time.
And it's a cost-saving measure, I imagine. But I it's extremely, like, not. It's not good.
No.
So... yeah, it's really bad. So basically,
got folks wading in sludge.
What happens, right, is that these cleanup workers are initially fine, right? Like there's no initial problems. Nobody gets hurt in the cleanup, seriously hurt in the cleanup. Nobody gets killed in the cleanup. But a few years later, like people, I'm trying to find the part of the article. So over a couple years following the spill, a number of workers start having health problems. And so as early as 2012, these workers began to report illnesses that they thought were directly caused by this cleanup. And by 2018, hundreds of workers had been sickened and 30 had died.
No.
Because basically of carcinogens, basically, yeah. The heavy metals and stuff.
People survived the initial flow, but the folks that are having to actually handle the material got dang, man.
Yeah, which really, really sucks. So, and it basically because they're basically given like rapid onset cancer because of this huge exposure to all these different carcinogens and heavy metals. So in 2013, 50 workers and their families file a lawsuit against a contractor that was responsible for the cleanup, Jacobs Engineering. The suit is dismissed by the judge, Thomas Varlin, who is presiding over the U.S. District Court for the Eastern District of Tennessee. That was later appealed. That decision was appealed to the U.S. Sixth Circuit and reversed. And the
good.
And so evidence was discovered.
Screw that guy. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
You can't just blatantly. I guess you can. This proves you can. He just put a blanket statement over all 50 cases. Nah.
Well, it's a class action, so it's a single case brought by.
Aye.
Yeah. So. So then it was discovered that the Jacobs Engineering had misled the workers about the dangers of coal ash.
Wear some gloves.
And that they had failed to keep the workers safe from those environmental hazards, mainly by claiming that extra protective equipment, such as masks and protective clothing, was unnecessary.
Yeah, when they start shaming you for wanting a little bit more protection for the thing you do every day.
Yes, exactly. Part of the overturning evidence or whatever is one of the TVA board members is reported to have told a U.S. Senate committee that he would not have allowed a member of his family to clean up coal ash without a dust mask. That's to me like what absolutely kills me is it's like literally like. It's not that expensive to give these workers dust masks and like gloves.
Like a like basic thing about it. A 3M respirator from Home Depot is like $4.
Yeah, well, I think more than that. $40.
Back in the day.
Like, you can get a really solid respirator for like $40.
You can go buy an industrial pack of those filters from DuPont. You know, just buy them in bulk enough for the entire project up to expiration date. And you probably get a discount. Like,
yeah. I mean, I just don't understand.
This is a small thing. Like it's a small thing to do.
It's gross negligence.
Negligence.
And malicious, perhaps, even.
No, it is predatory behavior on the employee. And
it is.
We talked about it before. This is why unions are important. These were contractors. They don't have the same protections.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's part of the critical thing about it. So this trial is going on. This lawsuit is happening. When did it start? In 2012. Yeah, in 2013, they bring the lawsuit. In 2020, so this is now seven, 8 years after the initial lawsuit, 52 workers reject a $10 million settlement offered by Jacobs Engineering.
Understandable.
Yeah.
Their lives got turned upside down. They've lost people. And you've got 50 different families, you said?
Yes.
$10 million from the government is a joke.
Well, it was not from the government. So at this point,
it's from the engineering
Jacobs
firm?
Engineering is the one. So basically, the TVA says, hey, we're not responsible. We hired these people to do the cleanup. And so it's their responsibility.
Brilliant risk management on their part. They just wiped their hands on that day one.
They did, right? And that's like the corporate
They're in
move,
a TVA
right?
truck in that entire picture.
And that's like, exactly, right? And like that's the... That's like the weird games that they get to play because they're a corporation, but they're also part of the federal government. But anyway.
Exactly.
So Jacobs Engineering, though, is like, hey, you know, they maintain that they acted appropriately. And so at this point, they have settled the litigation. The settlement is confidential, so we don't know how much the families received. But we do know that there was another rejected settlement for $35 million in 2021. So, I mean, I have to imagine...
It's somewhere between, like, 35 up, I guess.
I would have to imagine probably somewhere in, like, the $40 to $50 million range.
And it's, we got to say, a paycheck will never bring your loved ones back, right? And it's not, it's never going to be enough, but it is important for them to get justice for two reasons. One, so the family can actually persist and move on and try to live a happy life after this tragedy. And so it doesn't happen to the next family at the next coal treatment plant, you know?
And that's the thing is, like, you have to hit these corporations, like, where it hurts, which is the pocketbook, because that is
the only
motivation. That is the only motivation of a corporation is to increase profits, and getting sued for $50 million drastically cuts into your profits.
At least it'll get the negligent, like, board members that were a part of that, like
get them fired
from the board,
exactly.
Like, get the CEO changed over, if not the company dissolving completely, which, as we saw with Enron, ain't always the worst thing to happen, you know?
Very true. So, yeah, I mean, so that's kind of the litigation aspect of it.
Jeez. It's like these families get no rest. Like, years after this travesty, years after all of these folks, like, that they care about are hurt or pass away, you still have to relive this decades later just to get the small ounce of justice you deserve.
It's really, like, terrible.
They're not asking for much.
And, like, that's the thing that sucks about it is, like, a lot of this, you know, the corporations, they have the funds and the lawyers to be able to just drag it out.
Exactly.
And like, let's just drag it out and drag it out and drag it out.
You can't afford a lawyer for 10 years.
Yeah. And then the family's like, you know what? We just want to be done. We'll take anything. You know,
let me just move on.
That's legitimately a strategy that some of these corporations employ.
If I may, like, and again, this is what's happened with 9/11. You know, the firefighters that survived 9/11 and have had huge respiratory issues, they're still trying to get justice. It's 2023.
Yeah.
Right. And no one talks about it. It's like, I try to remember those folks because not only the folks that died the day of 9/11, right? But their families are still fighting.
Yeah.
And that's rough, man.
It sucks. It super sucks. And like, that's, I think that's interesting, right? So, like, we've kind of come to this place where, you know, we've talked about, you know, across all these different spills, like, how the evolution of the regulation, the regulatory bodies, and the avenues for people to get justice have evolved and changed. And, you know, I feel like we're, you know, we talked about, you know, 1814, with the, I think that was the beer flood, right? Let me pull up that list real quick.
I think so. Yeah. I should have remembered the dates.
1814 with the London beer flood, when it was, the loss of life was deemed as casual, accidental, and by misfortune.
That still makes me mad, that description.
That makes you so mad.
Casual.
And then, you know, to the Dublin whiskey fire, where it really was, I mean,
that was more civilian negligence. They got lucky with no one getting, like, bowled over. So, yep.
And then to the Great Molasses Flood, where that was really, like, the first class action lawsuit that enabled these people to seek recompense against the corporation.
It was that 1914?
That was 1919.
1919. So we're, like, 100 years later.
And we're 100 years later.
This legislation's happening.
And what's kind of happened is that the corporations have figured out ways to game the system to try to get out of it.
Yeah. I'm a corporate entity. Oh no, I'm a federal entity, but you wear whichever hat's convenient for whatever
hurdle
you're ignoring.
And then you're able to stall and just create such a huge expense to the legal proceedings that it takes an enormous amount of effort and combined effort in order to actually get it through.
Right. You know, Jacobs Engineering, when they're doing their budget meeting after that first year, they just budget out the legal fees to have them for a decade.
Absolutely.
And then that's that.
That's that. Know? And they're like, okay, well, we can keep operating and making money for the next 10 years, potentially, you know, and endangering other people.
Exactly.
Through that negligence.
Subcontract out under a different name, and who's going to know the difference?
Exactly. And they actually do change their name. They're now
did they really?
Called. They did. Yeah, they rebranded to Jacobs Solutions in 2003.
They didn't even change the core part of the name. All right, before we were Jacobs Engineering, and I'll admit, dropped the ball. Now we're solution oriented.
It's like Clark Kent putting on a pair of glasses, and so
for
I'm not
real.
Superman. I'm Clark Kent. Exactly.
It's so goofy. God.
It's pretty bad.
It's infuriating. Like, you mentioned the word to me, a phrase a long time. I never understood what it meant to be young and angry. And now, as I grow towards the end of my life, I'm still angry. It's just, it's so goofy, man.
I guess, it's wild. It's wild.
We keep seeing the same themes. And it's interesting, 100 years since that first class action lawsuit, and the only thing that really changed was the corporation's toolkit on how to whippity-wop the system.
And it took an appeals, and you'd think that you would think that and there were actually also actions, lawsuits and actions against the TVA.
They didn't get away scot-free.
They did not get away scot-free. Obviously they had to pay for the damages and stuff like this. Because
before they just kind of wiped their hands of it and blamed Jacobs.
For the cleanup, because all the people who died as a result of this tragedy were the cleanup workers.
Contractors. Yeah. I guess that technically isn't direct. They can kind of get the indirect.
Yeah. So the TVA basically, because they hired this company to do this job, the company decided how to execute the cleanup. So the company is what Jacobs Engineering is responsible for, basically the loss of life that happened during the cleanup or as a result of the cleanup, not the TVA. Now, the TVA was held responsible for a lot of the environmental damage and stuff like this. And there's a group of landowners who file a suit for $165 million against the TVA. The TVA is sued under the Clean Water Act. The TVA definitely gets their slap on the wrist, as it were, for sure, and they have to pay out. But they're not directly involved with any loss of human life, so they kind of get away.
So they got real lucky in that sense.
Yeah, yeah.
You're right. All those folks that got their homes bulldozed over, I didn't even consider the context of the housing crisis till you mentioned it. That's life-changing events, man. And folks that have lived there for who knows how long.
And one of the notes in here is that these people, it had a very large mental health effect on the people in the region. Because basically, they were sleeping and then their house got washed away, with them inside of it.
And
so,
things people don't think about that my family dealt with the Flint water crisis, right? Yes, there is a huge health risk, but the mental health risk of not know, for example, brief aside, and I'll get back on track. My granddad, before he passed away up in Flint, Michigan, to the day he died, had a garage full of bottled waters. Well, after they did all the fixes and said that the water's clean and the toxicology reports came back, this was years later. The mental toll that it took on him to keep his family safe, they never drank the tap water again.
Yeah.
Not once. And people don't see that part of it. So I hope that at least me telling that story, folks are still suffering from the Flint water crisis the same way folks are probably suffering from this coal disaster.
Absolutely.
These scars are not often healed and they are often not recognized, which I think in itself to feel that alone is something else, man. I just can't imagine.
Yeah. Oof. Heavy episode today.
Yeah, I guess the reason this one's a little longer, it is the conglomerate of all the weird fluid episodes,
It is.
It's the breakdown.
It is. But yeah, I think I want to end on a little bit of a more positive note, which is that, we've looked at all these weird fluid accidents and we have seen progress happening in terms of how do we try to prevent these disasters from happening in the future? And how do we hold those people who are responsible accountable? And even though this did have loss of life and it did have enormous loss of property, we are moving forward. There is regulation that has been drafted from this. The people who have been impacted are getting at least some justice now, finally. And I think that that is a an amazing thing, really.
Yeah, that's a net positive, right? I mean, it's sucked. Like, they say regulations written in blood for a reason.
And it is.
Right? You survive the initial disaster, and then the cleanup effort causes problems. But hopefully what the listener and what other folks, because I don't know who's going to listen to this, folks in the industries that are involved in this, being mindful of the past will save lives in the future. It always has. And I think we have to remember that mindset as we go forward with, because we're moving away from weird fluids, but we're going to start seeing some of these themes and regulatory hiccups and roadblocks and the tools that companies use to kind of sideline regulation, or we're going to start seeing these themes across different industries, right? And especially Absolutely. When you're talking about engineering, like engineering is a part of every piece of modern life.
It is. Absolutely. Well, Derek, I think we have gone a little bit over time this time.
Hey, man, it's our podcast. It can be as long as we want or need it to be. You know what I mean?
That's true.
I think it's good. Like, this was, for me at least, it feels rough to hear about all these tragedies, but I did learn something.
Yeah.
I do feel like I better understand the industry. And, you know, I know a little bit of a dirty secret of TVA every time I go over one of their dams.
That's very true. Well, Derek, do you have anything to plug?
No, besides us, you know, I'll check out the new branding. Tell us what you think. We'll be going under this assumed logo from the time being. And if you are a new listener and this is the first episode you've seen of Everything's a Spring, welcome. And please, if you have time, tell us how you found us so we can make sure that we're implementing ways to make it easier to find. Jim, you got anything?
Only the Whiskey Grail. It's a charred white oak drinking vessel for all your toxic sludge drinking needs.
Sip on it.
The charred white oak of the cup, which is made to mimic a bourbon barrel, will help tone down some of the harsh notes of the toxic coal sludge that you're drinking. And
its great construction will probably contain all that sludge, unlike...
It is, yeah, all of our whiskey grails are quality tested to ensure that they will not leak toxic sludge out of your drinking vessel while you are imbibing your favorite toxic sludge beverage. So yeah, pick up your whiskey grail at www.whiskeygrail.com.
These are my favorite ads.
You know, I try to be creative, just to, you know, have some fun with it, you know?
Man. Well, folks, on that note,
let's bounce.
Let's bounce.